was born in England in 1907. I came to Canada, or my parents brought me to Canada in 1909, about a year and a half old. And I was schooled here in Winnipeg at the Principal's Party, the Wellington, the Somerset schools. And I worked at my younger years, finally getting a job in the Hudson Bay Company in 1926, where I have worked for the war. My job was held open during the war, and I returned and worked until forced to retire through ill health at the age of 58. Canada declared war on September the 10th. It was on a Sunday, 1939. The extras came out. And I joined the Grenadiers on the 13th, 3 days later. I took basic training at Minto Armories. Later went to Fort Ogden Barracks, where we were put into quarters there. Had extensive training there, and in 1940, we were shipped to Jamaica, where we did garrison duty for approximately 16 months. In 1941, we returned to Canada, based in Winnipeg for a month, and recruited approximately 200 men to bring us up to strength. And we were shipped off to Hong Kong.
You were in the transport company at this time, right?
Yes.
Were you trained on artillery or guns of any
no,
kind?
No, they're strictly truck and Bren gun carriers. We were taking a course on Bren gun carriers when all of a sudden the order came through to be for us to be shipped out, and that was cut short. And away we went to Hong Kong.
Had you any idea where you were going when you left?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever, except that the officers were quite vehement in the fact that there would be no contact between us and the population. Because they did tell us that quite possibly we might have to fight our way off the ship. Of course, we were a bunch of young bucks, and we kind of figured that was a big joke, but it turned out it wasn't. And we were only in Hong Kong about 3 weeks when the Japanese attacked. So they knew more of the island than what we did. We were only just more or less training us into where different areas were, different names of places, where the roads went, and so on and so forth. And
did you do training maneuvers in Hong Kong before the fighting started, or was it?
We did just a little. You see, we were billeted in the peninsula of Kowloon, and they used to take us across once every other day. We couldn't take us all across, the whole regiment, but different companies would go across and spend a couple of days over there trying to learn the terrain and anything else that might be useful to us.
What were you using for transport at this time? I understand the transport never got there.
Our transport didn't get there, our heavier weapons didn't get there, our Bren gun carriers didn't get there. They hit us too quick, that was all rerouted to Australia. So all we had was our rifles, a few Bren guns, and the local trucks, Chinese trucks, which weren't too satisfactory.
Where were you when the fighting started?
I was in, practically the whole regiment was in on the peninsula in Kowloon. Of course, our main job was to protect the island, so we all retired to the island except A Company, which was up at the border. and they fought a rear guard action, and they finally were the last to come across. And from there, our transport was billeted in Wanchai Gap, which is almost the center of the island. The island, incidentally, is what, about 2.5-3 miles wide by 7 miles long, approximately.
How did you find out that the fighting had started? Like when the bombing came, or were there troops? Or?
No, we could. They tried to get across. There's about 3/4 mile of water there, and we could hear the gunfire from the shore of A Company, which was down on the pillboxes along the harbor. And I was up on Mount Stanley in number one ACAC post, which was supposed to protect regimental headquarters. And we could see the flashes of the tracer bullets and all that at night. And then the call came through for five trucks to go to Wan Lishan, where D Company was situated. Apparently the Japanese had made a landing, and A Company needed reinforcements, and we were to take them down. So five of us took off in our trucks. We got to Wan Lishan, and there was a cut in the side of the road with camouflage netting over it. We backed our trucks up in there, waiting for the final order. When they lobbed a shell over and hit the cliff just above us and set the netting on fire. We got our trucks out of there, got them out onto the main road. Lined up, the lead truck hadn't gone far enough down the road to let the last truck out from under the netting. So we hollered for him to go up further. He went up about another 10 or 15 yards. And then we saw something hit the road underneath his truck, and it was a grenade. And that's when we knew the Japanese had landed, and not only landed, but were up in amongst us, up in the hills. They killed three of our drivers there, along with quite a few of B Company, before we were able to take proper cover. And we were there, that was almost dawn in the morning when that happened. We were there all that day, sniping at us. And that night, I guess it'd be roughly about 11 o'clock, an officer from C Company was in there. I just can't think of his name now. He wanted three volunteers to go with him while he contacted his own company. So I volunteered to go, and two more transport boys volunteered to go. So we got out on the highway, and of course we had these big hobnailed army boots on, and didn't help quietness in any way. But we got down to a crossroads, about a half mile down the road, and this officer says, "I'm going up here," he says, "to the police barracks," he says, "to see what's going on down there." He says, "You fellas wait here." So we waited, and about a half an hour later, he came back with his guts blown out. Somebody had thrown a grenade at him. So we went down the road with him for a little ways, and finally we got one of our boys with an ambulance. We put him in there, and we got in ourselves, and we drove along. We picked up about four or five wounded on the way, and we got back to Wanchai Gap, where the rest of the transport was. And from then on, the Japs just went straight through the center of the island. They took the Royal Rifles at one end, Winnipeg Grenadiers at the other, and just pushed us straight back. So we had nothing at our backs but water. And that was Christmas Eve, and Christmas Day, the flagman up there, the governor capitulated.
So the army didn't really didn't really surrender, is that
no.
right? The governor of the island.
The governor of the island, for the sake of the population. You see, there'd be no water for over 10 days. They cut a water supply. I remember one of our boys, we used to wash our feet in gin. There was all kinds of booze, but there was no water. So, no, there was never any thought in our mind of quitting. But we were very poorly equipped in for that type of fighting, for a mountain region, you know. The Japanese, they had a little running shoe on with a toe in it. So they was just, and they landed with rations for one meal. The rest they had to get off the enemy or off the terrain. So that they could move much more silent, much faster than what we could. Because we had almost full battle pack on them. But never any thought of it. We had no air cover. Of course, they never used much air power on us. Mostly reconnaissance planes that they used on us. But they were, their espionage was fantastic. Didn't matter where a group of our officers would hold a meeting, they would drop a shell in there, in amongst them. Didn't matter where.
Were men pretty well able to keep in touch with their officers, or did it get scattered?
Well, it was pretty well shattered after the first day, because the first day I think they took about 25% of our officers and 40% of our sergeants was taken the first day. Espionage, I don't know. I guess the Chinese were definitely. Well, they had that whole place mapped out, and we did hear that these months before the war that there was funerals, but nobody was ever buried in them, and there was caskets of guns and rifles buried. But all they had to do when they landed was go and dig them up, and there was it.
And how did you hear about the surrender? Were you at headquarters company at the time, or?
Yes, the matter is that we slowly retired up to the top of this Mount Austin, and we were told to lay down our arms. We smashed all our rifles, threw the bolts down into the gullies, and made them useless for any further use. And we were just told to wait for further orders. Of course, there was isolated companies, you know, but I was with headquarters company, and finally a Japanese officer came up with a white woman as an interpreter, and told us where we had to go. We had to go down into Victoria. It wasn't too far, mostly downhill, but we had quite a bit of rations, and we managed to get a hold of a truck and an ambulance and loaded all our rations on that. They allowed us to do that. And we took it down to one of the British barracks.
Did that be North Point camp?
Not right away, no. We were in this barracks. I just can't think of the name, but we were there such a short time. We were there about 2 days. We were in there when the Japanese had their victory march through the main streets. And from there, we were shipped into North Point. And we were there, well, just for a year and a half. It was there that the four grenadiers tried to make their escape. Sergeant Payne and the other chaps, they never made it.
Did they treat you pretty brutally when you first capitulated?
At first. The Japanese that were fighting us were the northern Japanese. Not smooth-shaven ones with the little hairy whiskers and little hairy mustache. Not real chin whiskers nor real mustache, just a little bit of few hairs, you know. And they were mean. They took more heads off than shake a stick at. Well, during the fighting, they didn't bother with prisoners at all. They just take the head off, and that would be it. And after the fighting, when they were taking us down, if any badly wounded, they couldn't keep up. Well, they were just beheaded right there on the spot.
Was there any point where there was Japanese taken during the fighting by the Canadians?
No, not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, no. We were in North Point, as I say, about a year. And from there we went across the Kowloon into the Champshapo.
Into your old army barracks?
The old army barracks, which has now, I think, been renamed the Sergeant Major Osborne. He's at EC. Osborne Barracks. And then it settled into a... And from then they took these fighting troops of theirs out, and they had conscripted promotions for guard duty. And the situation changed a little because they didn't want no part of the Japanese, they didn't want no part of the army, and there was just guard duty. So they weren't too bad, you know. They were great ones for making deals, you know. You get into the cell, they go and sell it for you, and they were quite honest, they bring the money back. And 5,000 yen, I'd buy you 1 egg, you know, something like that.
I guess the food was pretty scarce. I'm interested to know, like you said, they let you bring your rations down. Did they confiscate your rations after you were interred?
No. We brought them down, and a lot of the boys packed a lot of their own stuff, their own personal rations. But when we got into this barracks, it was a regular army barrack, but I just can't think of the name of it. It was British. It was all turned in. They asked if we'd all turn it in into one common stockpile. And very few holdouts. Everybody turned it in, and it was canned rations and just the regular army type rations. And it did us for quite a few days, but it wasn't too long before we were on just rice, ordinary rice, and what we call green whore, greens, anything that could be, anything grew wheat. And once we got into Champshapo, and the routine was established, we were very lousy at the start. Terrible. There were no facilities for washing. Slowly but surely, they managed to get a water line in there, and the doctors explained to us the dangers of being lousy. So it wasn't too long before we were in pretty good shape. We had no clothes to wear. We had what's called, might I say, a G-string. And we had sufficient of them that we could keep them spotless. And our bedding, whatever it was, was a sack, keep that clean. So it wasn't too long before we were quite tidy and clean. Hungrier than hell. And then they started different work parties. I was on what's called number two work party, which consisted of, at the start, of digging holes, I would say, about 25 feet long, feet, 10 feet wide. It would hold 5 40-gallon gasoline drums. And they were scattering those all over the island, all over the peninsula. Right? That was called number 2 work party, and there was a real elderly Japanese in charge of it. And if you could say there was a good Japanese, he was. Because we got to call him Pop. And every once in a while, he'd back and do a sit down for 10 minutes, so he'd give us a 10-minute break and give us a cigarette. You know, he'd keep watching if any big shot came along, up, you know, we'd get up and do some work again. So everybody liked that party. And then they started Kai Tak Airport. That was a doozy. We built that, but we moved a mountain to do it by hand. Shovels and baskets. There's 2 or 3 killed in that operation. But you understand that the Chinese and Japanese, why they don't bother too much with modern machinery when they got so many people that they're just following each other across a few of these baskets of earth, and there's as much earth being dumped in that one spot as a 10-ton truck could dump. You know, constant. You can see just a big stream of men going that way loaded and a stream coming back empty all day long. But other than the starvation, of course, there was a lot of illness. There's beriberi, dysentery, malaria, diphtheria, pellagra. They all took their toll. I think the worst was diphtheria. But it was fast. Got that, it didn't last too long. Dysentery took the most, I imagine, because the diphtheria didn't last that long once they isolated the carriers. I think they found somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 carriers in camp, so they got those isolated. And those that, there was very few recovered that could get it.
Medical supplies, I guess, were pretty short too, right?
They were nil. They were nil, practically. No bandages, nothing. And we held sick parade every morning with Dr. Crawford. And all he could do was lend a sympathetic ear and say, well, carry on. I think penicillin was discovered while we were in prison camp, if I remember rightly. As I can remember Dr. Crawford saying, he sure as hell liked to have a barrel full of that stuff.
Japanese apparently didn't have any better medical supplies than Canadians.
No, because it was Hong Kong was pretty thoroughly blockaded. Electricity was all coal, manufactured by coal, and they couldn't get that in, any of that in. And I often tell my friends about being a prisoner of war in a Japanese prison camp, and we had pheasant for supper one night. It was a big coal storage plant when it went out, when they couldn't get coal in for the electricity. So they gave it to their own troops as much as they could possibly handle, and then they shipped in quite a few into us. There wasn't enough to roast them or anything, but they stewed them up in with the rice, and that wasn't too bad. But I can always say I ate pheasant in a prison camp. and then when the first air raids came over, American air raids, that was a day. They're all out there hooping and hollering, cheering. They hit a big oil storage tank, set it on fire, hit two or three ships in the harbor. In fact, one I saw, he never pulled out of his dive in time, he went right into the side of the ship.
Was this near the end of the war, or was there raids on Hong Kong?
No, there was. This would be about 6 to 8 months before the end of the war. Yeah.
So you stayed in Hong Kong the whole time?
Yeah. Yeah, I was on two drafts for Japan, but I was sick both times. One time I had beriberi. I think it weighed close to 200 pounds. I was just all blown up. You'd have stuck a pin in me out of it. Liquid would have shot out, you know. So the officer in charge of that draft, the Japanese officer, was inspecting us. They just wanted the best to go to Japan. You know. He stopped in front of me. He said, "You're beriberi?" I said, "Yeah." Out. But our worst, I do believe our worst enemy was the interpreter, who was born and raised in Kamloops, B.C. In fact, that's what we called him, was Kamloops.
Kamloops kid?
Yeah. He was mean. He used to tell us, and I said, "I haven't got the Canadians, but I went to school, made my life so miserable. But I've got something just as good." Holy terror.
You mentioned the bombing, the Americans bombing, and everybody I've talked to has talked about the Americans bombing. We're glad that the Americans were coming over and bombing. Weren't you scared for your life at any point that you might get hit by a bomb? Or?
No, they knew where we were. Their intelligence was pretty good too, in fact. Later on, I'll tell you how I know. But there was one or two, they weren't bought, I don't know what the caliber of machine gun they, one of these fighter bombers carry, but they're yay long, you know. That's great big things. So one of those did come through the roof of one of our huts and hit one of our officers in the leg. That was Lieutenant White, I believe. Of course, we all go under our beds anyway, and that started. But they kept coming more and more often, and more of them, you know. And of course, we'd be out cheering, and the Japanese didn't like that. They chased us back into the huts. And then, of course, as we went on work parties, we were afraid we walked wherever we went. We never got a ride. And there was a lot of Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps in with us. And they had friends and relatives on the outside. And they used to tell them, their friends, how things are going. And this one day they says, it's over, you know. So it was about 2 days, and they still kept their guards on, and our officers was trying to extract from them whether it was over or not, because nobody really knew, and they couldn't get an answer. And finally the Americans flew over and dropped leaflets, one of which I still have here, as a matter of fact, telling us that it was over and how to behave and what to do and so such things as they got in. But a Canadian cruiser came in strictly against orders. And the captain walked straight up the main street, right up into camp. They were very short of vegetables, even for the Japanese army. Every square possible inch of ground down in the peninsula was used. Canadians had quite a reputation as gardeners, so the Japanese took about 50 of us loaded us on trucks and took us, oh, I'd say about 25 mile inland to what used to be an orchard. Some big landowner at one of these warlords, I guess. We were up there, oh, I guess about 4 months. And then when they took their guards off and we had the freedom movement. They took a bunch of us down to this cruiser, this Canadian cruiser that came in. And in the officer's wardroom had a big map on the wall of the area. And there was areas drawn out on this map, the pins in them, you know. And I said, "What's all these?" And he said, "That's every place where there's prisoners of war." And there was one away up inland, you know. I said, "What's that one?" Well, he says, "They had about 50 Canadians up there gardening."
And you were one of them?
They knew.
Yeah. I heard you grew a lot of tomatoes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, we had lots of good fertilizer for it. Yeah.
What did you do to sort of keep your morale up? What kind of things were you doing to keep you from getting too down about being prisoners of war?
Well, I don't know. Kind of a day-to-day, you know. You lived for today only and hope to God you were still alive tomorrow. And two or three of the guys made hobbies. I mean, they get old sweaters and pull the yarn out of them, pull the wool out of them, and get different colored wools, and they'd make socks. And there was some wonderful work come out of there. I went in for woodworking. I made a crib board, and all inlaid. All I had was a razor blade and an old kitchen knife that I rubbed up on the stone, you know, and sharpened.
You made some picture frames, too.
Yeah, I made some picture frames. I guess they're gone by now. But, and then I inlaid the, in metal, Hong Kong, you know, mm-hmm. with the Chinese characters, or Japanese characters, you know, over there. And one of the officers spotted it. I mean, it was completely a round one. I got, he says, "That's quite unusual." He says, "I'd like to buy that off you." So it was no good to me. I sold it to him. And I got enough for an egg and to buy a bun off somebody else that smoked, you know, and stuff like that.
Did you smoke during the war?
Well, I smoked before the war, and I smoked since, and I smoked when I could get them in camp. That was our pay in camp, was 10 cents and one cigarette for a day's work. And your day started at 4 o'clock in the morning and finished up at 8 o'clock at night. That was when we were building the Kai-Tek Airport.
Did they leave the sort of internal running pretty much to the Canadian officers, or did they hand out the orders themselves?
Pretty. No, the officers were separated from us. They were in the same camp, but their compound was fenced in from us, and the officers was of course paid so many hundred yen a month. And our medical officers was more or less the ones that we had close contact with. They were the only ones that was allowed in. And, of course, being Orientals, they didn't put a Canadian or a English medical officer in charge. They put an Indian officer. I'm just trying to can't just think of his name again now. But he was in a bad age.
Did anybody get preferential treatment? I've heard stories where all the Indians were massacred after the battle took place. And then I've heard other stories that the Indians actually were given guard duty.
No, I wouldn't say they were given preference, but they were in a different camp, far removed from us. And after the war, our transport drivers, including myself, resumed our duties, which meant driving the ration trucks. Now, the Japanese were still supplying rations, although the Americans had dropped enough to feed a country. Fantastic what they dropped, and the fantastic accuracy of their drop. I think there was only one went outside the camp. So I was driving. I had a Japanese sergeant and six Japanese privates to do the work. And I was driving, and used to go to the women's camp, women's concentration camp, and the Indians camp. And they got the identical rations that we got, and that we had been given.
Who were the women? Were those nurses?
Women would be probably the wives of some English that were still there, medical people, and Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps. And there was children in there too.
Did they work on Kai Tak too, or did they?
Pardon?
Did they work on Kai Tak?
No. No, neither. None of the Indians didn't either. No, but we did. It was just Canadians, and we had some Americans, we had some Dutch. We had pretty well every nationality that was against the Japanese in there.
Did the Americans and Dutch come later, or were they there?
Yeah, they came later. There were a few flyers, mostly naval, and transport, you know.
Mm-hmm. Are the Americans treated worse or better?
No different really. But they seemed to want them together. They didn't put them in the same huts as ours. So there was a Canadian hut, and an American hut, and a Dutch hut, and this sort of business.
What happened to North Point after you went to Shamshui Po? Do you remember? Like, was it used for other prisoners, or did it just go vacant? Or?
Far as I could say, it could have been used for probably the Japanese. Might have used it as a barracks or something. I don't know. But the only time we went back to North Point is when we went to the island, if we had to go to the hospital. See, although the camp had a hospital, it was bare walls, concrete floors, and no beds, no nothing, you know. So if your dysentery case was bad enough, or some other thing was bad enough, and there was enough of you, they'd take maybe six or seven in a truck, stretcher cases, and take them across to Bone Road Hospital. B-O-W-E-N, that is, although we called it Bone Road, B-O-N-E. And that was a British hospital, and white sheets, beds, white sheets, nurses, white uniforms. Fantastic.
Did you get over there at all?
Yes, I went over there, and I had a bad case of dysentery.
You were blind in there, too, for like
eh?
You were blind if you were in the hospital.
Yeah, I went blind in Monroe.
From pellagra, or? You know?
Well, just malnutrition, nerve blindness, I think it was. It just kept getting dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, and finally I complained to the eye doctor. Well, he said, no wonder. He says, you're practically blind. And a week later I was. I could see that. And then what little bit of milk they were getting in there, and some sugar, brown cubes of brown sugar, and almost like a candy. You get one or two of them a day and a bit of milk. And slowly, sure, they return. Never as good as they were, of course, but...
How did you finally get from Hong Kong back? How were you repatriated?
I came back with quite a few more on the hospital ship, an American hospital ship.
How'd you feel about leaving Hong Kong after?
Whoa, no regrets. No regrets whatsoever. No. The very fact that we were heading home and alive. Those were the two big items.
Had you been in contact? Were you married before the war?
Oh, yes.
Had you been in contact with your wife?
Oh, yes. She got one or two letters from me, I think.
I got all your postcards, luckily.
And I got...
all of them sent out. And that way I was lucky because there was friends of mine that had their husbands over there and they didn't get any news at all. But while Bill was in the hospital, the chaplain printed out cards for me, but there was never anything in them about him being in hospital. It was just that he was well, alive and well.
But at least it was word.
Yes, it was word, and I was lucky that way.
I got, I guess, about 2.5 years before I got first word from her. I got a parcel. She sent me a parcel. And I suppose she sent what she thought I would need, which was clothes. Well, it turned out all right because I was able to sell them, and I lived pretty good for a couple of days by selling them.
And we packed the Red Cross parcels here.
Oh, the Red Cross.
But that was another one of them in 43 or 44, or was it?
That was the last year we were there.
Yeah.
That was another bad deal. We brought them in truck after truck after truckload, right into camp. And there was a big go-down, what they call a go-down, what we call a warehouse. Right in the middle of camp. And they piled them all. We saw them coming in, and we said, they loaded them all in this go-down and locked it up and drove away, and that thing outside of their own truck pulling up maybe once a month and taking the truckload away. That was it for almost 3 years.
Mm. We packed 100,000 parcels here that were supposed to go to Hong Kong, and they went to Quebec, and they were stopped there for a year, and they were repacked there. They had to take all the candy bars out. They'd all gone weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And they repacked them there, and then they were sent over to them finally. And they never got them.
Who did get them? Do you know? The Japanese get them? Or?
Well, eventually they released one per man. I would say about 2.5 years after the parcel actually arrived in camp. And, of course, the chocolate bars, they were just dust, nothing. But for the most part, it was canned stuff and dried food, so they were very acceptable, I'll tell you. And then, about 6 months later, they issued one to every three men. So we got one in the third parcel in the almost 4 years that we were there. And we left there, as I say, on a hospital ship. Some came out by plane, some were flown straight through the States. But we were taken to Manila. And the most fantastic setup you ever saw in your life. I had one massive tent there that would make this apartment block look small. I would say it would be possibly 300 feet long by 100 feet wide, and about every 5 feet there was a doctor all the way around it. And first they took us in there, and we had tents to sleep in and bunks. They got us billeted down all right and give us clean clothes. And said, the kitchen is never closed, boys. If you wake up at 3 in the morning, you're hungry, come and get something to eat. And a couple of days later, we all went through this tent. You went in one door, completely around the tent, and by the time you came out, you had a complete, absolute physical. Eyes, ears, skin, fingers, everything you could possibly think of.
What kind of shape were you in at that point?
A lot of them were in bad shape. I don't know why I wasn't in such bad shape as them, but I wasn't. I went down to 106 from 187 when I was captured. But a lot of them went down to from 250 to 86, this sort of business. I rather think it was on account of my age. I had pretty well finished growing. You see, I was 30, almost 32 when I joined the Army. I had finished growing. I'd been finished pretty well making bones, you might say. Whereas a young fellow around 18, 19, he still needed everything he could possibly get into his body to build himself up. Well, he just went on a slide.
And somebody said one time that with you being a butcher and handling meat all the time, you had absorbed that extra nutrition out of the meat too.
Yeah, one of the doctors mentioned that. He thought that could have had a bearing on it. But anyway, we're in Manila, I guess, roughly for 10 days to 2 weeks. Very hard for me to remember now. And then we were put on board a ship and taken right into Victoria.
Some of the men have told me that they had really little effects when they got back on Canadian food.
Oh.
Just from the changeover.
I don't think it was a changeover so much as what I found, that our stomachs had shrunk, but our appetites hadn't. And we'd take a whacking great plate full of food, you know, and figure, oh, man, what am I going to do to this? It's not even funny, you know. By the time they got 4 or 5 mouthfuls of it, they were absolutely full. We couldn't get another spoonful down. It was a richer food. And the excitement would have an awful lot to do about it, because there's flowers on the table, white tablecloths, pretty girls to wait on you, money in our pocket, new uniforms, freedom at the town, and I guess it was just a combination of all those things that they...
Did you get a beer ration when you got to Manila?
Yes, you could get... you go to the American, I think they call it the PIX, isn't it, the PIX. You'd get... bag of cigarettes, 4 Cokes or 2 beers, and nut bars and things like that. Every so often you go and get that. But I don't think too many of them tried that, the beer.
Just want to jump back for a minute. Were you in on any of the home brew that was made in the camps?
No, not in the camp. I did hear that it was being made, but I didn't get in on any of that. But once they took their guards off, me and 3 other fellows went through the fence and we went downtown. And we got into a place where they handled liquor. I guess it was sake, I don't know what it was. Because I was in the hospital at the time, a dysentery. And we started to drink this kind of stuff, you know. We just wasn't up to it, or at least I wasn't. I got violently ill. I managed to get back to camp on my own, and the other 3, I don't know how long they stayed out, but I came back home, was back to camp and flopped on my bed. And that's the last I knew till the next morning.
Weren't you a little worried? This is still back in camp. Were you not a little worried that you'd be shot or something if you were found outside the compound?
Well, I suppose we were, but it was worth the risk just to get out and not be constantly under the rifles. Another thing about this number two work party, we had the same guards all the time. There was only two of them. The work party consisted of about 40 of us. And these two would just lean their rifle against a rock and jump on a bus and go downtown. That'd leave us with old Pop. We weren't going anywhere.
Oh, one other question about the camp I wanted to ask before we get back to you coming home. And that was, were you involved, or your group of men involved in this sets of three or sets of five men or whatever it was that they instituted to?
Oh, yeah. They put us watching each other. I think this is what you mean. This was their way of doing things. That if one of us broke a rule, well, they went by a hut. There were about 100 men in the hut. Well, that 100 men was always, each one was responsible for the other 99. If he did anything wrong, if he was going to make an escape, for God's sake, take me with you. This sort of business, they put you to watching each other. And the whole 100 be punished for what one did. So we made darn sure that everybody pretty well pulled the line.
I heard the odd tale of sabotage on the airport.
Yes,
too.
Yes, we did sabotage. We were on one detail of washing gas drums. It was just a little screw cap on it, you know. We used to hose those out and clean them out thoroughly. And then these bits of brown sugar I'm telling you about, we used to save those. The periodic time we got them. And we dropped them in these barrels. And get the sugar in the gas, so that would fix up the motor pretty good. And the same was when we were laying the runways for the airport. I think they called to have it about 3-1, and we were putting about 7-1.
Sand to cement?
Yeah. So we, you know, little things like that, actually it was a joke, you know, we thought it was a big joke.
Were the officers aware, or the people that were ahead of you people aware that this was going on?
Oh yes. There was some of them that was patting us on the back, and that's fine, but don't, for Christ's sake, don't let me know. Mm-hmm. And then there was others that told us if we didn't stop, they were going to tell the Japanese. I won't mention any names. Some of our own officers was a pretty scared bunch of men.
Now let's get back to where you were in Manila and you were coming home. Did you go to the place in Victoria, or outside of Victoria, the army camp?
Yeah, I forget the name of that camp too now. Yeah, we were there for...
You were at Manila?
No. We quite a ways up in the interior. Beautiful camp. And that's what I was saying, where they have these flowers on the table and a white tablecloth and pretty girls to wait on us. And they give us $100 and turn us loose. So by that time, after 2 or 3 weeks in Manila, we'd started to look, you know, pretty good. I think I was back up to around 140, 145 pounds. just didn't take long to put it on. You had the frame, you know, and it's supposed to have been there anyway. And so.
But it wasn't solid yet.
No. No, it was still.
The boards themselves, and it wasn't solid. It was just some of them, when they got home, they were just flabby.
Yeah.
White and flabby, because it went on too fast. There was no way it could take hold and be real muscle.
No toning up, just
no.
Putting
no,
it on.
No, that's right.
It was just the weight.
Yeah. And we were in no condition to give physical exercise to, you know, to kind of tone us up a little bit, along with the food. And we were there for, it was only a couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah.
Well, about 2 weeks, I think. And then
it was 2 weeks in Victoria.
He brought us over on a ferry. Well, we were supposed to get, I think we were supposed to get right on the, no, we were supposed to get right on the train because your sister was there.
You were supposed to get the train the same day.
Same
you
way.
You missed the
yeah.
train because my sister was there and took you home. I had a sister in Victoria, too, that mm-hmm. entertained him while he was in Victoria, and then my other sister looked after him and entertained, had him to her home, Vancouver. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to get home on Monday night, the 14th of October. We got home on Tuesday night. 15
yes.
October. But in the meantime, I got
24
American Beauty roses
with
a telegram.
Were you one of the first ones back to win? You couldn't have been, I guess, if
no,
you were
no,
4 weeks in the interim.
I imagine I was pretty close to the last one. I guess there was only about three of us on the train the next day. Coming in, of course, they were coming in by air from the States. There's a lot of them flying, being brought in by plane. I think it was Gordy Williamson and myself. There were only about three of us on that train. I know the conductor was quite put out about it. He cursed us prisoners of war because he had more trouble than trying to find bunks for us, you know, than we were on the train that we weren't supposed to be on.
Was there anybody besides your wife out to meet you at the
Oh, yes. Yes, my whole family was there. My sisters, my husbands, and their
all
children.
All the children. All my family.
And
friends.
My mother and dad.
Interested to know how the bad nutrition and the lack of vitamins and that affected you after the war. Like, you mentioned that you had to quit work early because of ill health. Do you feel that was due to the...
Definitely, they proved it. That's why I took a series of heart attacks. That was about 6 years ago.
65, November 65.
First when I was in neuralized for 6 weeks. And when I came out, told me I'd go back to work for a couple hours a day. So I did that for the first week, and then I added an hour every day. Within 2 weeks I was working full time. I just got nicely back in full time, I got another one. I was back in the hospital again, so he said that would be enough of that.
Were there many ill effects before you had the heart attacks that sort of gave you a warning that you shouldn't be working?
Well, that's kind of difficult to say. I think my circulatory system was all shot to the devil because my legs have never been the same since. Even now, even today. And my eyesight, of course, and my hearing. Anything connected with the nerves seemed to have gone haywire, and definitely no sign of recovery, even with the better living conditions.
Did you have to fight for your pension, or was it not sort of given?
Not one iota. I never asked him for a 5 cent piece. In fact, I was the second man on the Winnipeg Grenadiers to get discharged. And I was discharged on a Thursday, and I went up to the Hudson Bay store on right after being discharged, about 4 o'clock, I got up there. And I said, I'm out of the Army, I want to come back to work. Fine, he said, we'll start you Monday morning. I said, no, you won't, you'll start me tomorrow morning. So I started on a Friday, worked Friday and Saturday. And I worked, 6 months, eh? Finally, I got a letter from DVA to report to the Pioneer Building, is it? Or is it on Pioneer Avenue?
Pioneer Avenue.
Yeah. Anyway, DVA building. So I went up there. I had to take an hour off work to get up there. And the chap up there, I guess he was a doctor. I don't know. He said, didn't anybody ever tell you you had to go to Deer Lodge? I said, no. Well, he said, you get up there tomorrow morning, he says, sharp. I said, okay. So I went up to Deer Lodge. First thing I knew, I'm taken up to a ward and shoved into a bed. I was there for a month and a half. And every test under the sun, you know, and I came out with 40% pension. I had no intention of trying to get a pension at all, because I just figured that was another, as I say, another phase of my life, a job that had to be done, and somebody had to do it. So I did what I could about it, and that was that. I was quite willing to go back to work and forget all about it. So I got 10% for my eyesight, 10% for my ears, and 20% for general disability. I held that for a year, and then they called me in for a reboard. Checked me over again, and I came up with 20%. 10% for my eyes, 10% for my ears, and my general physical condition had improved to such an extent that they didn't require a pension. And of course, this heart attack hit me, and after I went through the reboard again on discharge from hospital, I got a letter from Ottawa stating that they had traced this back to 1942. So that kind of made them responsible, they felt. So I went from 20% up to 80%, which is what I get today.
So you don't really have any beef with the government about the way they've treated you when you came back?
None whatsoever.
Do you think the association has been out of line, or do you think that they've sort of done their cause in fighting for pensions for the men?
No, I think they've done a wonderful job myself, especially in that branch of their work. In looking after the widows, seeing that they got a fair shake from the government, which is the most important thing. Because while the man's still alive, somehow or another he's gonna make sure that he's okay, but when he's gone, and the widow has got to have somebody on her side.
Just to wrap it up, you obviously wouldn't go again now because of your age, but how did you feel about the war while you were there? And
at the time, there was nobody going to interfere with my way of life. And this is what Hitler wanted to do. He was going to force his way of life on our way of life. And I took it personally to be my way of life. And I said, well, not. I'm going to do something about it. So I joined the Army. I was 32 years old. Old enough to know better, really. But after I got home, and I've read papers since that have come out, I think the whole thing in that end of the world was awfully botched up. Churchill didn't want anybody to go in there. He didn't want any Canadian troops in there. He said that it could not be defended. But his own parliament overruled him, so they asked Canada for 2 regiments. And even up to that point, they still figured it would be garrison duty. I never thought they would attack it.
And guns all pointed to sea, too.
All pointed to sea, yeah. And they said they never could come over those mountains, you know. So they not only came over, but they brought small field pieces with them. So knowing those things now, I might do if it happened again, and I was, know what I know now, and I was young enough to go, I would do a little more research. Before I jumped in. Because I could smell it coming, I could see it coming when Chamberlain came back and said, no, peace in our time. I knew darn well he was talking up a tree.
Well, that's a good